There's my dry cough.
Oh dear, you can only laugh.
Hello, Dominic. How are you?
Hi, Katie. I'm fine. I also, of course, developed a dry cough. I shouldn't laugh about it. Sorry, everyone that's having a horrible time out there. This laughter is merely out of anxiety, but I think it was just a psychosomatic cough. I'm like the most health anxious person in the world, so this crisis is great for me, but I don't think I'm going to infect you over Skype.
Good to know. I'm also having quite an anxious and uncertain week, same as everybody else, really. But mine hasn't been helped by the fact that, like everyone else in France, I have joined the current literary trend, which is to read The Plague by Albert Camus. It's not really a good week to be reading it, but it is a great book. I'm really enjoying it.
Why would you do that to yourself?
It's just like the zeitgeist, isn't it?
My husband's reading this seminal book about the AIDS crisis in America called The Band Played On, which also I was like, why now?
Not a good time to be reading literature about infectious diseases. We're going to try not to talk too much about coronavirus this week because it feels like people are talking about nothing else right now. But I do want to send our love and support, especially to our Italian listeners. We hope you're staying strong in all of this craziness. It's just absolutely mad what's happening.
Yeah, it's really mad. And I'm getting really angry with the people. Well, no, I understand why people are playing it down, like to try and be relaxed. But I get really annoyed when people are like, oh, only a few thousand people have died of it and all these people die of other things. And it's just annoying that some people don't seem to understand what exponential growth can do. Anyway,
at a time when lots of people are putting off travel plans, this week we've got a reminder of all the relationships that rely on the ability to move freely around Europe. And it's also, I think, a cheering conversation, which is something that we need right now. Who are we going to be talking to this week, Dominic?
We are going to be speaking to Saara Turunen, who is a Finnish writer and playwright. She contributed a beautiful essay as part of a new book called Europa 28, which is published later this week. But first,
Who's had a bad week, Dominic?
It's been a bad week, particularly for the Czech Prime Minister, Andrej Babiš. He went on TV last week and ranted and raved about a group of MEPs from the Budgetary Control Committee of the European Parliament who are currently investigating him for allegations of conflict of interest. He went on TV and described Monika Hohlmeier, who's a German Christian Democrat, as insane and said that the two Czech MEPs on the committee were traitors.
Wow.
Yeah, and when a pumped-up populist leader describes the people investigating him as traitors, things can turn nasty for those people. The Czech MEPs and their family members soon started receiving death threats and had to request police protection.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Who was sending these death threats?
I don't know. People who believed the Prime Minister when he said that they were traitors.
So just to like remind people, what is Babiš supposed to have done? Like, why is he being investigated?
So it's regarding an alleged conflict of interest whereby millions of euros of EU funds were apportioned to a company which Babiš has strong ties to, which I just did air quotes for that because it's a company that he set up. He was the CEO of this company until he became finance minister. And he was also the sole shareholder until he was forced by the Czech parliament to transfer ownership to some trust funds.
This all sounds like a very above board setup. I think it's fine.
Totally fine. But actually, according to a leaked report from the EU Commission, they still think he has rather inappropriate ties to the company. And it seems like he'll be able to take the reins again once he's left power. So, yeah, he certainly seems to have strong ties. The company in question is Agrofert. It is a conglomerate that holds more than 230 companies, kind of agriculture, food, chemical, construction. Oh, and two national newspapers and a radio station, a political leader who owns parts of the media. We've seen that before in Europe, haven't we? So the money that Agrofert got from the EU is mainly around farming subsidies, which is that huge pot of money that makes up about 40% of the entire EU budget. And Actually, I really recommend, if you are interested in this, you should read the New York Times article that they wrote in December last year about this rather opaque world of EU farming subsidies. And yeah, it's a bit concerning. I'll put a link in the show notes. And it's probably worth pointing out that Andrej Babiš is the second richest person in the Czech Republic. He's a rich and powerful guy, and he really does not like that he's being investigated. Hence why he verbally attacked the people investigating him. Hohlmeier, the German MEP that he described as insane, came back fighting. She described his language as hate speech and a blatant attempt to intimidate MEPs. She said, "This unbearable degradation of the style of political discourse requires a clear reply." David Sassoli, who is the president of the European Parliament, is taking this very seriously. He said the comments were unacceptable and that he would be referring the case to the Commission and Council leaders. This is all very ironic because Andrej Babiš broke onto the political scene as a figure who talked about systemic corruption in the country, and now the EU are soon going to rule on whether or not he himself has been involved in some corruption. I'm sure his vitriol on TV won't have done him any favours with the people investigating, and the backlash has clearly shaken him as he went on the radio and did eventually apologise to the Czech investigators, saying that it was just hyperbole and he was exaggerating.
Well, that's nice. That's more than we get from like the other billionaire populist leader who talks like this.
That's true. The bar is set rather low. Still, the damage has already been done, so I think he deserves bad week.
This guy gets compared to Trump, right, a lot because he's a billionaire populist. Is he also right-wing? Like, what's his deal?
Well, this is the kind of strange thing about him. His party sits with the Renew Europe group in the European Parliament, which is Macron's happy band of pro-European centrists, and not exactly the place you'd expect to have this populist leader there. His party is in coalition with the Social Democrats, and their government is propped up by the Communist Party. So it's kind of seen as a motley crew of left-ish and very left-wing politicians.
Hmm.
He's a strange one, doesn't fit into the obvious mould.
Intriguing. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what comes out of this one.
Yeah, we'll see what happens if he does indeed get found guilty of a conflict of interest. Maybe then he'll have really bad week.
We'll introduce a new category, especially for Mr. Babiš.
Who's had a good week, Katie?
Well, I wanted to talk about Greece this week. And yes, I am well aware that the good week section of this podcast is a very weird place to put that, because the last couple of weeks have not been good weeks at all for Greece. And if there wasn't a massive international health crisis going on right now, I think we'd all be talking about it a lot more. I'm going to do a quick recap of what's been happening, which is going to sound a lot like bad week, but hold tight because I am going to come back to the more positive developments at the end. Okay?
Okay.
So, quick recap. Weekend before last, Turkey announced that it was going to start letting refugees start crossing into Greece again, something that had been stopped 4 years ago under a very controversial agreement with the EU. And in recent days, there have been some really seriously ugly scenes at the borders between Greece and Turkey. About 35,000 people started moving en masse towards Greece, having been told by the Turkish president, like, go, we encourage you to make this journey. Greece, however, did not want these people entering, and they sent troops to the land border to try and push all of these people back with tear gas and rubber bullets, and it got very violent. Some vigilante groups have also started patrolling, trying to stop people from crossing. And there was this particularly horrible scene on the island of Lesbos where people stopped this boat from landing, even though it had a pregnant woman on board. Greece ended up saying, no one is allowed to apply for asylum and we're going to just send you all home, which is actually illegal under European law, but that's by the by. Apart from being horrible for everyone involved, this whole thing has really shown what a shambles Europe's refugee policy is. Basically, back in 2016, we decided to pay Turkey 6 billion euros to make this problem just go away, except it didn't really go away, it just got put on hold. And over the past 4 years, we've done very little to come up with a policy for actually dealing with migration that is coherent in any way. The one thing I think our governments agree on is that migrants are unwelcome. Ursula von der Leyen turned up at the Greek border and she thanked Greece for being Europe's shield, in inverted commas, which is a really interesting way of talking about people who are turning up asking for our help. So yeah, our governments agree that migrants are unwelcome, but that's kind of it. Greece and Italy have been left for the last few years to deal with these crazy numbers of people arriving without nearly enough support from the rest of Europe. And we've never worked out a way of spreading the burden properly. And on top of all of this, we've also refused to pay Turkey any more money to stop the arrivals because EU leaders don't want to look like they're caving into Erdogan's blackmail and rewarding him for breaking the agreement in the first place. Which I guess is, maybe to be expected. So the whole thing is a mess. But remember,
this is good week.
This is good week because I wanted to draw attention to the fact that there have been some less terrible developments and we should celebrate those when we can, I guess. So good week goes to the five countries that have agreed to take in some of the unaccompanied children who've been stuck on the border. Those five countries are Finland, France, Germany, Luxembourg and Portugal. There's very few details right now about how many kids we're talking about, but German media say it's likely to be about 1,500 children. And quite a lot of the pressure on this has been coming from cities in Europe, like Leiden in the Netherlands and the mayors of cities in Germany, like Cologne and Düsseldorf. They've been telling their governments, like, look, we need to do something and we would be happy to take some of these kids in. So well done, mayors.
Presumably a city mayor like the mayor of Leiden doesn't have the power to just say, yes, come here without his government agreeing to it.
Yeah, and actually the Dutch government, the Dutch Prime Minister was like, no, we're not going to take any of these kids. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen on the Dutch front. But then Germany is one of these five countries that have said, yes, we will take some of these kids in. So I guess some of those kids will go to cities like Cologne.
How monstrous can our leaders be to not accept unaccompanied children living in squalor?
The British government did that for quite some time when it came to the Calais camp. So quite monstrous, I guess, is the answer.
It's awful.
Anyway, I think we should recognise that there are people out there trying to help, even if the general situation is pretty terrible. It would be nice if it was a bit less ad hoc, the solutions that we come up with for this kind of thing. But it is really fundamentally hard to come up with long-term solutions on this in Europe, I think. Europe ultimately just doesn't want to welcome migrants in, but it also spends quite a lot of time lecturing the rest of the world about human rights. So it's just like those things are really hard to negotiate.
Yeah, they are. And I do agree with you that we should celebrate the acts of kindness and the acts of humanity, even if they are way too small. So we've got some concert tickets again to give away. So listen up, if you are living in
Portugal, Lisbon specifically,
and
Dortmund in Germany or thereabouts, then there's a couple of cool shows coming up that you might want to go to, and we have two sets of free tickets for each of them. We have these tickets courtesy of Live Europe, who are a collective of really cool music venues around Europe, and they promote up-and-coming European singers and bands. They're great, and we really like them. Last month, they gave us a bunch of tickets to give away to see the Norwegian jazz singer, Charlotte Dos Santos, and we heard reports back that she was incredible. This month, we have tickets up for grabs for two very exciting new acts. Green Tea Peng, who's a very cool British R&B artist. This is what she sounds like. This is Downers.
I can't smell the flowers, felt empty now for hours, lost my power. Now I can't smell the flowers, I'm sick of all these towers. Think I've done too many downers.
We have two pairs of tickets available to see Green Tea Peng at Music Box in Lisbon on April 23rd. And also two pairs of tickets to see the French band Lysistrata in Dortmund, Germany. I've actually got family in Dortmund, but I don't think they're very into math rock, so I'm not going to give the tickets to them. Listeners in Dortmund, please give us a shout if you want these tickets. And actually, we're going to be playing some Lysistrata at the end of the show. All you need to do for a chance to win them is tag us and our friends at Live Europe in a social media post. We will put more info in the show notes.
So Katie and I have long been fascinated with cross-cultural relationships. I happen to be a mom myself, and whilst you might scoff at the idea that a Dutchman and a Britishman being together could be described as cross-cultural, believe you me, we still come across cultural differences, even though we've been together for 5 years, that can both cause joy and friction, and it can sometimes take a while to unpick those cultural differences.
What was like the most recent one that came up?
Well, I think we're having some cultural differences when it comes to dealing with the coronavirus and how careful we should be. But maybe that's just also me being really neurotic.
Probably it's just you being neurotic.
I can't blame everything on my British citizenship. I nearly said German. Ooh.
Oh.
That's because I am also German now.
Congratulations. You are becoming German.
Thank you. I am cross-cultural myself now. But this week we are speaking to someone who wrote a really nice piece about her own cross-cultural relationship and in the context of the European project. She is Saara Turunen and she is a Finnish writer and playwright.
Yes, Saara was recently asked to write a piece for a collection of writing from female writers all around Europe. It's called Europa 28 and it comes out tomorrow, March the 12th. I was lucky enough to read it already and it has some really, really lovely pieces in it. So go get hold of it. But one piece I really liked was Saara's piece. And it stood out because I think for a lot of people, the idea of what Europe is like quite abstract. And Saara just took this as an opportunity to write about her own relationship with her partner. He's from Barcelona and he still lives there. So they've had this 10-year relationship going from Helsinki to Barcelona. And it struck me that that is like a really nice personal example of what European integration looks like. It's all of these personal relationships that help us to bridge cultures in a way. So we rang up Saara and had a really nice conversation about long distance European relationships, as well as what feminism looks like in the two countries that she lives in, and a bunch of other stuff. When you were asked to write about Europe, why did you choose to write about something so personal as your own relationship?
I'm basically all the time flying between Helsinki and Barcelona, and I thought that's something very characteristic about my relationship with Europe. And I thought maybe I could, in that way, like offer some kind of a personal point of view. Like, I think many times when we talk about such a big themes like Europe, we speak about, I don't know, immigration or money or Brexit or very difficult things, but we maybe lack this kind of emotional side of it. And I thought maybe I could offer that. You know, the simple fact that Finland decided to be part of the European Union in 1995, that's something that defined my destiny somehow, because I think if that didn't happen, you know, my life wouldn't be maybe like this at the moment. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, we both liked the personal element, and we both are of the same school. We believe that personal stories can help explain wider, yeah, phenomenons. So you wrote in the story about meeting your partner for the first time and being surprised at how he smiled all the time. I was wondering, 10 years later, are there still lots of moments when it feels like there are big cultural differences? And if so, what kind of things?
Yeah, I think there's all the time. There's so many, many of them. Maybe I just got used to them better than 10 years ago. But I think there's very concrete stuff like, I don't know, eating times or the food in general. Or like if I eat dinner with my partner's family, they talk very much all the time and they talk everybody at the same time and they don't maybe listen so much what other people say. They just need a lot of talking and noise. In contrary, when my partner eats dinner with my family, it's very weird for him that, you know, one person talks and everybody else listens. So it's like two different kind of conversation cultures, and that's something that keeps on surprising me still very much.
Do you think Finland and Spain have got kind of the most different cultures you can find within Europe in some ways?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I can only talk about my own case, but I would say that there is big cultural differences. Maybe that's also something attractive. Like, I think that's one of the reasons why I'm still with my partner, because he's so different, and that's also something fascinating, I guess. There's also like these very big like differences concerning the values. Like in Finland in general, we appreciate a lot work and achieving. And this is at least in my family. In Spain, at least in my partner's family, they are very much more like family orientated, and they love to come together and eat good food and drink nice wine. And they have like very nice manners, like they always give these two kisses to each other. And I think Spanish people in general, they are very talented in saying nice stuff about each other. And I think in Finland, we might have this kind of difficult to express our positive feelings. We somehow maybe express ourselves more through our work. That's at least how we explain it to ourselves.
And in your work, you write books and plays, and you write a lot about gender inequality. I was wondering, has your experience with Finnish and Spanish culture, have you seen a difference in the way feminism is treated in Finland and Spain?
I think there are some differences. Like, I think we have some nice things in Finland that we already achieved, like we have free daycare and free education system for all the children and young people. And I think women can really benefit a lot from that system. Like, I think it's easier in here, for example, compare your work and your family, you know. But at the same time, we don't have a gender equality here either. And we do have a lot of problems. Like, we do have a lot of domestic violence, for example, like Spain has also, of course. But I think one nice thing in Spain is that they admit very much their problems, you know, like they always talk about this, that, this is a very machist culture. And for example, in the Spanish news nowadays, I think they talk a lot about this kind of gender-related violence. In Finland, this problem is a little bit that we don't admit that we have problems, you know, like I think many times we are told that, oh, we already achieved the gender equality, like, why should we make a problem out of it? And I think that's something that really, like, keeps us behind. You know, you cannot really develop if you don't admit your problems, you know?
Yeah, definitely. You also write a lot about the pressure to feel normal in society. Mm. And I find that a really interesting theme in your work. Why do you write about this pressure to be normal so much?
I think it might have something to do with my background. Like, I'm from this pretty conservative and middle class family. And I was many times told when I was a child, like, not to stand out of the crowd and not to draw attention to myself. I learned it, you know. But then later on, I thought that I wanted to be an artist. And if you're an artist, you need to draw attention at least to your work, you know. And somehow, many times it caused me like an inner conflict. I remember first time when I was thinking about this thing, I was in this workshop in Berlin, this artist workshop, and we were asked to dance, like do this very complicated choreography. And I couldn't really follow, and I was really standing out of the crowd, and I felt so shamed, you know. And I remember later on writing in my notebook, like, I would just like to be normal. And then at the same time, I somehow realized that the normal doesn't exist. We all have our own normal. And I think the normal depends on who defines it. But yeah, I think like if you have this kind of a conflict, it's also something that makes you want to do art out of it.
And I imagine being in a cross-cultural relationship also can sometimes make you feel like nothing you do is normal. I'm in one myself. And I also sometimes feel like, oh God, everything that I thought was normal, that I thought I was like, what, isn't actually normal at all for other people.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Do you think that if there were more cross-cultural relationships, Europe would be a kind of healthier place?
Maybe. I don't know, but I just know that these relationships exist already and they have always existed and they might exist in the future also. So I don't know. I think that these kind of problems are all the time solved in this kind of cross-cultural relationships. And it's not a problem. You just solve them. So yeah, it might be. It might be more healthy if there were more of them.
Do you think it's changed you as a person, being in a cross-cultural relationship?
Definitely. It's been a very big journey. Like, I think I saw my culture in very different kind of eyes. And there were also times that I didn't love my culture at all. But I think during the years, I also, like, learned to love my culture again. And I think it's very important. Love the both cultures, because all the cultures have like nice things and not so nice things, you know.
Zooming out for a second, do you think that art can have a role in addressing the problems of Europe?
I think it can. At least me personally, I think I have understood many things through art, like, because I think art speaks always this kind of language of emotions and feelings, and it's kind of like a different language that you can always understand, although you don't understand a different culture. And I, for example, love to see art in Spain or in Catalonia, and, you know, like, for example, read books. And I think they have told me lots of these kind of things that I couldn't read from newspapers, for example. I could somehow see the experience of people. And I think it's very important and rich.
Europa 28 is out tomorrow in all good bookshops and probably bad ones. You should check it out. Sara is also the author of two novels which have been translated into English and a bunch of other languages, so check those out too.
Okay, this week's happy ending is actually really a joyful one for once. And it comes from Northern Italy, a place that really could do with some joy this week. The joy came in the form of something that seemed almost like a religious miracle. Residents in the small settlement of Settecani were astonished when their taps started producing a red liquid instead of water. The red liquid was nothing to be scared of. It was, in fact, something rather unscary. It was Lambrusco, the fizzy Ooh. Italian wine that maybe doesn't have the best reputation, but who's going to complain when it starts coming out of your taps for free?
I'll take a tap full of Lambrusco. How did this happen?
Well, apparently it came about because the pressure of wine in the pipes at the nearby factory built up so high that the wine found an exit through the water pipe that's normally used for cleaning. Mm-hmm. So, sadly, there was no divine intervention this time, but it sure provided a lot of happiness. There was a really nice quote given to the Italian press agency by one of the locals. He said, "I was washing some stuff in the kitchen. I turned off the tap. I turned it on again. And instead of water, I saw wine. I said, Allegria. And we toasted."
That's so nice.
It is really nice and possibly would be quite terrifying if you didn't know what it was.
I mean, you wouldn't want it long term, but just for like an hour or so, a nice time could be had.
Do you think it's actually fake news and this is just like a way of Lambrusco getting free advertising? Have we been duped?
Oh, possibly. But I wouldn't mind it.
Do you like Lambrusco?
I like all sorts of fizzy wines. I'm not fussy.
But Lambrusco does have the reputation of like being the worst, yeah?
In the grand scale of fizzy wines, I'm not sure. Isn't Asti supposed to be worse? I don't think we should be like scorning anyone's wine, especially Italy's right now.
That's true. I'm sorry. No, Prosecco's great, but Lambrusco?
Dominic, you're going to get the Lambrusco lobby after us.
I reckon what's going to happen is people are going to say, yeah, that's true. You get really cheap Lambrusco in supermarkets, particularly in the UK, but it can be a delicacy if you get the good Lambrusco.
A bit like how Cremant, which is kind of like the budget version of champagne in France, like cheaper fizzy wine, is becoming kind of posh, especially in England. It's really interesting.
Everything's a fad.
If you're in self-isolation and bored, why not go for a walk around your home while listening to our back catalogue? That's a fun thing to do.
Seriously, my family in Brabant, where people have been asked to self-isolate, I was getting loads of text messages this morning of them catching up on our podcast that they missed. And it was really good for them. So why don't you do it too?
You can also come and hang out with us on social media to banish the boredom of being in self-isolation. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, and Facebook. If you just type in the Europeans Podcast, you'll find us there.
Also, if you want to help us out a little bit and give us a little bit of money each month, that would be really nice. You don't have to do it, but we really appreciate all the people who are very kindly supporting us on Patreon. You can join this nice bunch of supporters on patreon.com/Europeans Podcast, supporting us from as little as $2 per month.
We're going to play you out with one of the bands that you can go and see for free if you get hold of some of these tickets. This is Lisistrata, who are going to be playing in Dortmund with Different Creatures. Have a good week, everyone.